It is now time for our main speaker. Please welcome Brian from Los Angeles.
Good evening, family. My name is Brian D. from Los Angeles. My sobriety date is August 31st of 2005. I've got a sponsor. His name is David G. I've got a home group. It's the Arlington Group in Los Angeles. It's the oldest running, self-proclaimed longest running group in Los Angeles. We've been around since February 11th, 1943. I've worked for the steps a couple of times. And, you know, if you're an alcoholic of my type and kind, my late sponsor, Philo Hagen, would be happy to tell you that one of the things that he loved about the Arlington Group in Los Angeles is the consistency. When you go to that meeting, there's no question what you're going to get on a Tuesday or Thursday night. You know that, you know, Father Terry was going to be sitting up in the front. Ty's going to be sitting over here. The speaker is there. The speaker's guest is there. Philo and I are back over there with the guy in the white shirt. The guy saw the newcomer next to him, and we were right. That's where Philo and I were. And, you know, it was straight shooter Alcoholics Anonymous. There was no questions. There was no surprises. And there was such this sort of, you know, mystique about it when I came to it. And actually, mystique was similar meetings that when I got sober in Chicago, Illinois, similar meetings to that. I didn't know what it was, but Philo pointed out to me, it's the consistency. Before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know what was going to happen on any Tuesday night. I didn't know if I was going to break out in handcuffs. I didn't know if my dad was going to go off the deep end and like take a car and do something. You know, I didn't know if my dad was going to beat the crap out of my brother or me or rip my face off like he threatened to do so many times, you know? So coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and coming to Arlington and meetings like that and having that consistency and that regularity, knowing what's going to happen on a Tuesday night, that's what I needed. And, you know, before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, like, there was so much uncertainty. I was always running, like the book, you know, always running, always looking over my shoulder. And it just got exhausting after a while. It got really exhausting, constantly running, constantly looking over my shoulder. And that's not a way to live. And, you know, I mentioned the abuse that I suffered from my father's, you know, mental and physical abuse from my father. And that's not, you know, that gave me a reason to drink, but it's not what made me an alcoholic. I had my first drink when I was about 6 years old. It was pink champagne. And I think, you know, in my household, it was okay if you drank underage as long as you were with my parents, you know, so you could have a wine cooler or some champagne or whatever, but as long as you were with the adults. So my sister had some pink champagne left over from her high school prom, and it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I woke up with this satiating thirst. I just had to have something to drink. So I ran to the refrigerator, the pink champagne's bubbling. I didn't know what it was. I just knew it was pink and it looked fun. So I grabbed it, slugged it back. And the first thing that I noticed was, oh, this tastes disgusting, right? But the second thing that I noticed was this sort of elusive feeling as it trickled down the back of my throat and went into the pit of my stomach, and it warmed me all up. And I was like, ooh, that feels kind of interesting. And it didn't feel good or bad. It was just different and interesting. And I kind of liked it, but I hated the taste. So what did I do? I took another swig of it. And that's like the literature tells us, you know, although I admit it injurious to me, after a time, I can't differentiate the true from the false. And so, you know, I know this is probably not good for me because it tastes like crap, but I like the way that it makes me feel. So I'm gonna take another swig. And I had my first drunk. I was about 16 years old. And I was up at the neighborhood trailer park with about a bunch of quality individuals. And we went to the Hy-Vee. I don't know if any of you are from the Midwest. They have Hy-Vees there in Iowa. That's the grocery store. And so we went to the neighborhood Hy-Vee. We found an unhoused individual get us. We gave him, you know, however much it was, like 20 or 10 bucks or whatever. And he went inside and got us like our own fifth of Iowa's finest five-star whiskey, and we got a 20-ounce bottle of Coca-Cola Classic, and we each had our own fifth, and we were just glugging, you know, back, and we shared the 20-ounce of Coca-Cola Classic as a chaser, right? So we, you know, more alcohol, definitely just the Coca-Cola, just to kind of chase it back to get the wash that taste out of your mouth. And I remember passing out and throwing up and passing out and waking up and throwing up, and it was just a night to be seen. You know, I was not a vision for you from the get-go. There was nothing social about my drinking from day one. It was like I drank to get messed up. And I want to rewind here. Welcome to all the newcomers. Congratulations to all the chip takers. Congratulations to all the birthday celebrants. I want to thank Jose for coming out and joining me here tonight on our drive from Los Angeles. We had a nice conversation in the car on the way here. And I want to thank all these beautiful people about four rows back on the left. I'm calling them out. John, Laura, Scott, and Manny, my tribe. Thank you for coming out and supporting me and being here with me tonight. It's really great to see you. And, you know, welcome again to the newcomers and the chip takers. You know, when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember there, you know, in Chicago, there was a meeting called Never Took a Legal Drink. It was by Hazelden. And I got sober when I was 22 years old. And I thought, how cool is that? Never took a legal drink. And I was kind of resentful at them because, you know, I got sober when I was 22. So technically, I took a few legal drinks, you know. But I was like, oh, those are the cool kids. You know, those are the cool kids. And so if you're here and you're young, I see a lot of young people out there in the crowd and new people, you know, coming for the first time or returnees or whatever. Welcome. Like this is like the next, this is the best thing for you, for me. Actually, I found this was the best thing for me. But see, I had opportunity to come even before 22 to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready because if you're an alcoholic of my type and kind, if you have even a little glimmer of hope, I had a little glimmer of hope. And I was still going, you know, I got, oh yeah, I'm okay, I'm fine. My friend Paula, she stopped by my apartment and she dropped off a big book and she said, hey Brian, I'm just gonna leave this big book over here on the table. Are you happy? And I said, yeah, I'm fine. And thank you for reminding Jose. At my meeting, the Arlington group, we have a tradition of no cursing at the meeting. So, you know, I'm glad to hear that you guys allow cursing here. Arlington, if you come there, please don't curse because you will violate our traditions. But so I can go ahead and say this without having to filter myself. But I said, I'm fine, fucked up, insecure, neurotic, emotional. Yeah, I'm fine. I really thought I was fine, right, when she came over. And there was a checklist that she gave me. And it had about 20 questions on it. And I started reading the questions and I went down. I think I checked most of the questions, right? But there was somewhere at the bottom, or maybe my friend told me something. But ultimately, like if you checked three or four of these, you're probably an alcoholic. But ultimately, it's the decision's up to you whether you're an alcoholic or not. I'm like, well, there's my out right there, right? I checked 20 of them, but the decision's up to me. I'm not an alcoholic. So I'm not an alcoholic. I'm fine. I don't need your help. And so I didn't make it in, or, you know, that time. It took about six more months from that point for the wheels really to fall off. But I'm going to rewind a little bit back to that trailer park. So, you know, that was about 16 years old. Progressively, it got really bad after that 16-year-old trailer park incident. I started drinking pretty much on every weekend with my friends. When I got sick that first time, I thought, okay, it's the whiskey that got me sick. So I'm going to switch to vodka, right? Vodka, that'll solve it, right? So I have my own little, I don't know, is that like a half gallon, the one with the handle, right? So we had a half gallon of vodka and we're driving around Southeast Iowa, like glug, 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 you know, the bottle, you know, see the bubbles going back. And then fast forward, we're at my high school, Notre Dame High School, about graduating class, about 30. And it's winter break, there's snow on the ground. I've got my brand new Guess jeans leather jacket on. And, you know, I decided to go out into the snow and my friends who I just kind of confided something really big in this friend that was, you know, one of my best friends. I told him something very personal about myself and I was kind of hoping he told me the same thing about himself. But instead he said, you're pulling my chain, right, Brian? I'm like, no. Anyways, so fast forward, that same friend, he gave me a dare to, I won't repeat it, but to call out some expletives in that Notre Dame parking lot where we're drunk. And so here I am calling out these expletives in front of my entire graduating class, rolling around in the snow in my brand new Guess jeans, a leather jacket, and just, you know, acting a fool. And, you know, and I thought that was cool. I thought that was cool. It gave me courage. Alcohol was my liquid courage that Jose talked about. because, you know, I was kind of a wound up type kid, you know, and alcohol gave me wings, and it gave me the ability to be myself, or so I thought so. And so then, you know, fast forward about, you know, a week or two after that, I told my mom, I came out to my mom, I told her I was gay. And she said, "Brian, what are we going to do? What are people going to think of us? Oh, we've got to get you on hormones." And so, you know, that didn't really fly with me. So I called my sister and I told her, I said, "Michelle, you know, I just came out to mom. I told her I was gay. She wants to put me on hormones." And she says, "Well, Brian, you know, I'm a lesbian, right?" And I said, "Oh, I had no idea." I guess everybody knew except for me. So anyways, I fast forward, I moved to the big city, Des Moines, Iowa, with my sister and her lesbian lover. And the first weekend there in Des Moines, Iowa, I just arrived. It was a Saturday. And I got my little Isuzu Rodeo, and I had to find, you know, go about hour and a half east of Burlington to, you know, the bar, the nightclub that I was looking for. And that night I got my first DUI. How appropriate, right? My first weekend out of the house and my first DUI. And I've been arrested for possession of alcohol by a minor prior to that. But now I got a DUI and I'm 18 years old. And I just moved out of home and I'm making my sister really proud, right? And fast forward about, you know, right before I was graduating from high school, I got a full ride, 4-year scholarship to any Iowa Board of Regents college of my choice. And I was out late one night. I came home and to my sister's house, and she had kicked me out because I wasn't communicating with her, and she accused me of being on drugs. And I said, "How dare she accuse me of being on drugs? I'm not a drug addict. And you know, I'm gonna teach her a lesson. I'm gonna teach her a lesson." So what did I do? I went and found some drugs and used them to teach her a lesson. And I guess it was probably Tylenol or ibuprofen that they gave me. I don't know. It didn't really do anything. But I was off to college, right? I was off to college, and my little Isuzu Rodeo, all my stuff was already packed for me. And I was off to Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. And I went to my first day of class, and that night I found the bars. And the bars there were just so interesting. You know what I mean? They were so interesting. There was so much going on there. So exciting, and they had what I was looking for there, right? And the bars became so much more interesting that night that I'm not sure if I went to class the next day, but if I did go to class the next day, I didn't go to class the day after that. So I got a full ride to Iowa, and I just let it go. You know, alcohol was more important than my education. Alcohol was more important than free school. Alcohol was more important than my relationship with my family or my friends. Alcohol was making all the decisions for me. And I didn't realize it at the time, but, you know, this disease, they say it's progressive, and that's exactly what happened. And I said, "Okay, I'll drink alcohol, and then maybe I'll do a couple other things, but I'm never going to do this, right? Okay. I'll drink alcohol, and maybe I'll do a couple other things. And the other thing, but I'm never going to do that because my brother does that and that's really bad." Okay. You know, fast forward, you know, about a year later, I'm at the Saint nightclub in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. It's about 2:00 in the morning. And I see all the people around me having a good time like this. And I was never really able to handle my alcohol, right? I always overshot the mark, always got sick, always too dizzy, you know, always overshot the mark with alcohol. But I see these people that are, you know, it's like 2:00 in the morning, they're wide awake and they're having a great time. And I'm like, I knew exactly who to go look for and what to do and what to happen, who had it, right? And, you know, all the lines that I drew in the sand for myself, they kept just washing away. And I drew them further along and then further along until I was in the middle of the ocean drowning. And that's exactly what happened to me. You know, I had no moral compass for myself. It was just, you know, didn't matter. Didn't matter. Anything goes for Brian. And so I was homeless in Miami for a hot minute, literally like a hot minute, I think of one night. And then I called my mom and I said, "Hey, mom, I'm homeless in Miami. You know, can you get me home?" And so I went home to be with mom, and I realized I couldn't drink like I wanted to around my mother. So I'm like, I don't think I'm going to stick around, Mom. I've got to go. See you later. You know, and so I fast forward. I ended up in Chicago. I lived in Chicago for about 10 years. And that's where I got sober, in Chicago, Illinois. And in Chicago, things progressively got really bad and really dark. I broke out into handcuffs a couple times. I got charged with 3 Class X felonies. Conspiracy, illegal enterprise, and drug trafficking. And thank God, you know, I don't know if you guys believe God, but I believe there was someone looking out for me, because I could be in prison for 20 years right now for what I was arrested for. But, you know, through a series of miracles and, you know, the support of, an amazing lawyer and my mother and my father, I was able to, you know, not everybody has that fortunate, you know, but I was able to, thank God, not behind bars today. And, I'm able to sit here and share with you that message, a message that, you know, there is hope. And I didn't see it at the time because, you know, after I got arrested for all those things, I got back out. My lawyer told me, shut down candy shop, Brian. You got to shut down candy shop. And I got back out. I'm like, well, if I got to pay my lawyer, how am I going to shut down candy shop, right? I've got to pay you to get me off the hook for the things that I was doing. So instead of like thinking like, maybe I need to get sober, maybe I need to stop drinking, maybe I need to stop, you know, close my street pharmacy business, right? Instead of thinking that maybe I should shift those things, my solution was, okay, you know what? It was FedEx. It was FedEx, and it was the fact that I had it sent to my condo. FedEx, they're federal, right? So let me switch from FedEx to UPS and see what Brown can do for me, right? So let me see what Brown can do for me. And let me have it shipped to my friend's flower shop. And it was never like, you know, I never tried to, you know, get sober. I just tried to manage the consequences. I was like, okay, I have all these consequences. It has nothing to do with my alcoholism. Let me just go ahead and just manage these things, right? And my friend Paula, about this time, she stopped by my apartment, left that big book, and then I got arrested shortly again after that. And I broke up into handcuffs again. And I got out again, and I was on house arrest, you know, still drinking, still, you know, running amok. And I finally got off house arrest, and I was living in this dark basement apartment in Chicago. I was more squatting there than anything. I wasn't really living there. I was kind of, there was a guy that I was kind of staying with, and, you know, he was allowing me to stay there. And then I guess I was too much of a mess. I just got off house arrest, and he was like, okay, Brian, I'm moving out. I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm moving out. And so he left. And he left me there by myself. I'm waiting for the guy to come down from upstairs to tell me, you got to go, Brian. You know what I mean? And it just got to a point where I couldn't not stay sober. Like, I was struck sober. No matter how much I put into my body, I was sober. There was nothing that could mask the pain that I was feeling. You know, and this was only 6 months after Paula had stopped by my apartment. And every last ounce of hope had been snuffed out from within me. I was spiritually bankrupt. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to turn. I didn't know who to call. I just felt just completely empty inside and hopeless. And it was just me in this basement apartment that I was squatting in with this picture of Christina Aguilera from Genie in the Bottle on the wall. And I laid down in that bed, and I just curled up in a fetal position, and I just began to sob. You know, uncontrollably sob, just so much pain and emptiness. And I just didn't know what I had done with my life. You know what I mean? And I thought about, oh, well, I don't know what I'm going to do here. What am I going to do here? And I thought, well, I have $100. Maybe I can go hire a hitman to kill me. You know, maybe that'll be it. Maybe he's just going to take my $100 from me and, like, you know, hit me over the head or something. But I just wanted, I didn't want to continue living. And suddenly the alcoholic prayer just naturally oozed out of my lips. And I cried out to God, God, please help me. And, you know, it wasn't a God that I grew up understanding that I was afraid of. It wasn't a God that, you know, I had been running from. It wasn't a God that I had said all these foxhole prayers to in the past, like, God, help me get out of this one this time. You know, it'll be different the next time. God, please just help me with this one this time. It was the most natural prayer that ever came from me. And there was no strings attached. I kind of hoped that I was going to go to bed and wake up, or not wake up and die, right? But I was willing to take whatever the solution was. I was willing to do whatever the solution, whatever God was going to present me with. I had no more answers. Whatever it was, I just, whatever God had in store for me. So I fell asleep, crying in the fetal position. And then the next morning, about 9 o'clock in the morning, my doorbell rang. It wasn't my doorbell, right? It was the place where I was squatting, this doorbell. So the doorbell rang, and I opened the doorbell. And if you were kind of an alcoholic like me, no one's ringing your doorbell at 9 o'clock in the morning. So I opened the door, and there they were, Paula and Daniel. And there they were, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and they were glowing. They were glowing. They had the spirit of recovery. I didn't know it at the time, but I knew they had something that I wanted because I didn't have anything left inside of me. And Paula, she talked about having a year of sobriety. And I was like, whoa, Paula has a year. I can't even imagine having a year. You know, I couldn't even think about that at the time. And then Daniel, he talked about having 60 days. And he's like, if I can do it, you can do it. I'm like, yes, you're right. If you can do it, I can definitely do it. Because, you know, if you knew Daniel about 60 days before that, he was not a vision for you. He was not even a vision for me. Daniel and I had many, you know, not so fun encounters together. He was my co-defendant and many other things. But here he was standing right across from me. He had color under his skin. He had a smile on his face. He had a job downtown at Marshall Fields. And I'm like, I want a job at Marshall Fields. Marshall Fields doesn't exist anymore. For those of you who haven't heard of it, it's a department store in Chicago. And I was like, oh, I want a job at Marshall Fields. How cool would that be to work at Marshall Fields? And so his sponsor, I guess, worked at Marshall Fields, who later sponsored me. And I got a job at Marshall Fields too. But I lost it quickly in sobriety. But Daniel talked about having 60 days and he was smiling. And I remember he was laughing. And I remember, wow, Daniel's laughing. And I kind of remembered, like, you know what? I didn't have the ability to laugh. And that's when I really knew something was wrong with me. When I began to realize something was wrong, like, my partner at the time used to watch these episodes when YouTube just came out. I think it was YouTube at the time, right? But YouTube just came out. He was watching these little, you know, 10-minute videos on YouTube. And he would just be laughing. SNL or Donatella Versace, little skits and everything. He'd just be carrying on laughing. And I'm like, it's not funny. Nothing's funny, you know. And it could have been the most hilarious thing in the world, but it was not funny to me. I didn't have the ability to laugh. But there Daniel was across from me smiling. And I wanted what he had. And so off to rehab I went. And Paula asked me again, she said, Brian, are you happy? And it was the first time that I was finally honest with her and with myself and with my higher power, you know, and I said no. And I began to sob because it was like, I knew at that time that I had sort of unleashed something. I let the genie sort of out of the bottle. Doesn't mean that I'm going to be sober for the rest of my life, but something happened in that instance where I was honest with her and I said that I'm not happy. That I can never like put that back in the bottle, you know what I mean? Admitting that I'm not happy because of my alcoholism. And so, yeah, I admit it. And it was like, I was just sort of standing there at the edge of the cliff and just made this decision to jump. And it was like, I'm terrified of heights, right? But it was like this sort of terrifying but exhilarating thing all at the same time because I knew my life was never going to be the same again. I knew I was trying something different that I could not imagine going 2 minutes without alcohol. I could not imagine waking up and not putting something into my body. I didn't know a life. I couldn't imagine a life without that, right? That was not something that I ever thought of doing. And here I am talking about never drinking again for the rest of my life. That is terrifying. That is terrifying. And it was terrifying for me. And so, you know, it was exciting, but terrifying because I didn't know what else to do. So I was off to rehab and I went to rehab and this lady, Beverly, who was my counselor, she talked about powerlessness. And it was such a foreign concept to me, like powerlessness, like what is that? Because I was so powerful, right? I was such a powerful person. I was such so full of ego and so controlling that I couldn't imagine having powerlessness. But there's this beautiful thing that when you're powerless, I later found out, you know, through working the steps with a sponsor, when I'm powerless and I give it up, I can now find a power from outside of myself to keep me sober because I'm by myself, I can't keep myself sober. I mean, I can kind of carry on for a little bit, right? But I need to eventually connect with something outside of myself that I learned later on. And I'm going to tell you all about that. So before getting to rehab, they said I had to be clean for like 10 days or something, sober for 10 days. And I called around, like, going to get to a detox or something like that. I didn't have health insurance. The hospital wanted about $20,000. So I'm like, okay, I'm just going to squat on this guy's couch for like about 10 nights. I know that he's like a safe place. I'm just going to hang out here. And about after day two or three, I got this bright idea to reach out to some people that were probably drinking like I used to drink. And as I'm going out the door to over this these people's house to drink, like, I totally forgot that I was staying sober, right? And as I'm going out the door, they sent me a text message. I think you could text it. They sent me a text message or reached out to me, right? And they said, hey, there's someone over here. They know you. They don't want you here. They say you're sketchy. And I'm like, wow, how dare they? But looking back at that, I cried out to God for help like 3 days before that. And I have no tools right now, right? And I fully believe that that was God, my higher power, intervening in that moment when I didn't have any power over the choice of that next drink. Boop, you're sketchy. They don't want you over here, right? And so I made it through that 10 days, got into rehab, Beverly started talking about powerlessness. Foreign concept to me, powerlessness. And she talked about reservations. I'm thinking like, okay, for dinner? Like, I don't know what reservations are. But I was so brain fogged when I got into rehab that, it was like Charlie Brown, right, was what it sounded like. I do remember there was a guy that came from an outside group to speak, and he was wearing this shirt that said, Grateful I'm Not Dead. And I'm like, yeah, that's the cool kid over there, the Grateful I'm Not Dead shirt. I want to be like him. I want to come into these meetings and share and speak with these people, you know? And I connected with him because he was an alcoholic, you see. And so fast forward, I got out of rehab. I was in some sort of supportive or structured environment for about 3.5 years, from rehab to a halfway house to a three-quarters house. I needed that because I didn't know how to live life without alcohol. I had no idea how to live life sober. And so they taught me everything that I knew. There was this guy when I went to the halfway house, there was these two guys, Henry and Al. And Henry said, I believe in human sacrifice. He said, some of you motherfuckers are going to die so the rest of us can live. And he terrified me. And I said, shit, Henry, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. But see, That's the crazy thing about it, because just like 60 days before that, I wanted to die. I would have greeted that. Oh, yeah, Henry, I want to die. Thank you. Where do I sign up? But something cool happened. Like after going through rehab and going into this halfway house and listening to these guys and taking some suggestions and doing something that, you know, I didn't think of myself, all of a sudden I had a little bit of hope. And I didn't have a reason to die anymore. And that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I wanted to die, and now I want to live. And so I met my sponsor, David G., who sponsored my Eskimo. Everyone know what Eskimo is? I don't know. Eskimo. I learned that when I moved to Southern California, Eskimo. Also, we don't do birthdays in Chicago either. That was really cool. That was like the excitement and bigger of sobriety in Southern California is exactly what I needed when I moved out here at about 6 years of sobriety. Like, it's just, you don't get this anywhere else in the U.S. So, you know, you guys got a good thing right here. Don't take it for granted, because it's really amazing, Alcoholics Anonymous in Southern California. But Daniel, my Eskimo, he had a, you know, David was his sponsor. So David sponsored me too. And David was talking about going to college. I'm like, I'm going to go to college. Okay, I'll go to college. I had about a year of sobriety, and David's going to college. Okay, I'll do that too. I didn't get sober because I wanted to go to college or get a job at Marshall Fields or any of that stuff. I got sober because I was miserable, right? I was hopeless. I wanted to die. But this really cool thing happened when I got sober and I stopped drinking. Alcohol stopped making all the choices for me. I could do whatever I wanted. Pretty much, except for drink or use drugs, right? I could do pretty much whatever I wanted. I could get a job at Marshall Fields. I could go to college. I could move to California. And I did just that. When I was drinking, I had a lot of great ideas, right? But I could never materialize it. I could never put it together. I wanted to go to DePaul School for New Learning, you know, to give me credit for my real life experience as a street pharmacist. I went like on a high speed through this degree, degree and get a degree in, you know, 2 weeks, right? But I couldn't even call, like, the school to inquire about it. But when I got sober, I can do, you know, I went off to college. And in high school, I was about a C minus average student, right? But this cool thing that happened in sobriety, my mom used to always tell me, Brian, if you only apply yourself. And oh my gosh, that was like the worst thing she could tell me. She wanted me to apply myself. I don't want to apply myself, Mom. So she's like, if you only apply yourself, Brian. And I said, I don't want to apply myself. Well, the cool thing that I found out in college was if really half of college is just showing up and doing the work that's assigned to you. And so my first semester of college, there was this guy, Professor King. He was his first year teaching college. And there was this girl, Stacy, who was in class, and she was also sober. And halfway through the semester, Professor Kane told us that he was going to give the highest scoring grade in the CAS, this Golden Herodotus Award. It was a Greek father of history, if you don't know who Herodotus was. And for the highest score in the class. And so, you know, I just showed up. I listened to the instructions. I, you know, did the homework and I took the test and I, you know, did whatever was asking me. And I scored for the highest grade in the class, C minus average student before. I applied myself like my mom told me to do. I showed up for class and I got the highest grade in the class. The cool thing that happened was Stacy and I tied for the highest grade. The two alcoholics tied for the highest grade in the class. And so he gave me this book. And on the front of it says Speeches That Changed the World. And it had Winston Churchill on the front. I opened it up inside and it said, In Coram Paro, look it up. And so I looked it up and it's a quote from Michelangelo that means, yet I am learning. And that's exactly what my journey of Alcoholics Anonymous has been like. It's a journey of lifelong learning, right? My friend Joey says, what's ripe rots, what's green grows. And spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection, right? And so I have to remain teachable. And when I remain teachable and I continue to learn, every day there's a lesson for me to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the pain is usually a great motivator for me. But there's, you know, I always find ways of bettering myself. And, you know, I'm not a saint. I'm not a spiritually perfect, nor do I claim to be, nor do I think I will ever be. But I continue to learn. I continue wanting to better myself. I continue wanting to grow in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what Professor Kane taught me. And I graduated college summa cum laude. That was not in the cards for me. You know, I didn't ever think that I was going to graduate college because I remember I threw away that full ride, 4-year scholarship to Iowa. And this time I graduated from college and I paid for it with my own money, right? Before it was going to be free, now I'm paying for it. And so after I graduated, I moved out to Southern California. And after I moved out here, May of 2011, I moved out to Southern California. In August of 2011, I got a phone call from my mom. And she told me, this is the same mother I was a mama's boy growing up. You know, I was there attached to my mom's hip and, you know, all my aunts and uncles gave my mom a really hard time. I used to sleep in bed with her until I was like 10 years old or something like that. I mean, I was a mama's boy, right? And then when my mom said those things to me, you know, it was really hurtful. And I felt like, you know, abandoned in some aspects. She was doing the best she could with what she had, you know? And so I got a phone call from my mom. Fast forward, my mom was my number one cheerleader. Me going getting sober, she was right there for me. At my graduation from rehab, she was there. You know, she was my cheerleader. She was in my corner. But I still, you know, felt that disconnection with her after what had happened, right? And so she called me. It was August of 2011. I don't remember the exact date. But she called me and she said, "Brian, I've got cancer. I got breast cancer, and." I'm going down to Tijuana to get treatment because it's this holistic place that I want to get treatment at. And all my family's back in the Midwest. She has no family out here. I said, okay, Mom, I'm going to be there for you. I'm going to be there to support you. And my mom would have been 81 years old today on July 6, 1944. And so I was going down there every weekend, going down there to see her on my days off from work. She wanted these little, you know, these holistic ice creams from Whole Foods and just different like holistic items that I bring from Whole Foods across the border, cross over to TJ and go over to the cancer clinic that she was in and spend time with her. And I would come back and go to work and then go back down there and spend time with her and then come back and go to work and go and back and forth and back and forth until Christmas Day of 2011. It was just her and I there. And, you know, it was Christmas, Christmas Eve, Christmas Day. We celebrate, you know, the Eve, and we give gifts on Christmas Eve. And so it was just her and I there in that cancer clinic. And on the way down, I stopped by Walgreens and got some, like, little booty socks for her to wear comfortable in her bed. And I had a picture printed out from our graduation. She was so proud of me when I graduated college, you know. And that was only, like, a few months before that. And I printed it out, and I got there, and she was just so happy to see that picture. It just really lit her up. Thank you. That picture just really lit her up inside, and her little booties. And I laid there on her chest. And for the first time in a long time, I felt that motherly connection that I had missed so much. And she said something to where I knew that she accepted me for who I was at that time. And I just felt that connection with her that I had missed for such a long time. Until she told me, "Brian, you're heavy." And so I realized that I was suffocating my mother, who was dying of cancer. And I had to get off her chest because it's not about me, right? And so I got off her chest. And, you know, she passed away on January 3rd of 2012, so just a few days after that. And I was able to be there for that, right? And shortly after that, I lost my mother. I lost my big boy job that I just got out of college. They let me go. They called it company restructure. And I was living in something they called the bedevilments. And if you haven't heard of those, look them up. They're in the big book. It's what happens when you're an alcoholic, is not working a program, a spiritual program, is not connected spiritually. And I was resentful, and I was rageful, and I was probably just as miserable as I was before I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, before day one of sobriety. I mean, I was in a lot of spiritual pain and turmoil. And ask my roommates, they'll tell you. And then I just lost my mom. And then I realized what the problem was. See, I used to go to this meeting called the 12-step house in Chicago. And this guy used to always share about the only step you have to work perfectly is step one. The first half, the first step in the first year. I don't recommend that. But he said, after that, he said, the rest of the steps are about changing your life. And I'm like, perfect. Now that I got alcohol off my back, my life's great. I'm going to college. I got a job. I got money in the pocket. I'm not always looking over my shoulder for the police. Everything's awesome, right? And so I didn't realize that I had a lot more work to do until about 6 years of sobriety after I'd lost my mom, I lost my job, and I wanted to die again in sobriety. And I remember what that guy said. And I was like, oh, shoot. I've got to do the rest of the steps. See, I was doing a thing called the two-step. And I was, I definitely knew I was powerless over alcohol. The writing was on the wall with that. And I would come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and share with all of you my experience, strength, and hope. Right? But instead of sharing my experience, strength, and hope, I was more like coming to meetings and spewing my venom is what was happening. I was coming here and spewing my venom. There was no solution. And so I knew I had to work the rest of the steps. So I found a meeting called the Home Group, and I met my sponsor at that meeting called the Home Group, Philo Hagen, and he walked me through the steps. And he did something really funny, Philo did. He told me, "Brian, I love you." And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? That's really weird and kind of creepy, you know? You love me. And he's like, "No, you know, it's like Southern California. It's a California thing, you know, like just like love you, man. I love you." And see, I had this icy core around my heart when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that hadn't been melted for me yet. It was not allowing me to connect with you or anyone else. And what Philo did was he taught me how to melt that ice around my heart and how to really love another alcoholic and how to love all of you and how to connect with all of you and how to feel the love and compassion that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. And so Philo and I worked through the steps. And there's a really cool thing. If you haven't worked the steps, if you open the big book, it tells us, we're going to show you precisely how we have recovered, not from alcoholism, but from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. That's exactly where I was at 6 years of sobriety, seemingly homeless state of mind and body. And so we read the book, and then it just like there's fun, something funny that happens when you read it. It tells us, and now we're at step one. It tells you, oh, you just read it, and it tells you what step you're on. Like step one, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were a real alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. And then it just tells you, and then we were at step two, and it tells you the steps. I'm like, oh, wow, who knew that? That's so clever, right? Well, people who wrote this book knew that. And Philo took me through it, and we read it line by line, and we did the steps. And when we came to step three, I'm like, I don't know about this, Philo. Like, the God that I understood is, like, you know, kind of scary. They're like, well, you can pick your, have your own idea of God. You know, it doesn't have to. And like, Catholics aren't really down with that. Like, I can just pick out my own idea of God. You know what I mean? But then I remember, you know, the day before, like day minus one, I cried out to God for help. So I have some conception of God. Thank you. I have some conception of God. And so, you know, I cried out to God for help. So I developed a God of my understanding and the God that I was excited to be behind. And I went through the steps and I shared it with Philo. And I said a lot of, you know, scary things on my fourth step and fifth step, things that I never thought I would share with anybody. And then I got to step eight and I made amends with my father. And if you knew my father, going to see him, I was telling my dad, I was telling Philo, like, hey, I'm terrified of going to make amends with my father, like for my life, right? Because my father, you know, he got arrested for guns. He was holed up in the trailer when like the SWAT team had came around. You know, I didn't really, I was, for good reason, it was not a unnatural fear. It was not, you know, it was a healthy fear that I had of my father. And I told Philo, like, I'm scared. He's like, just go down there, Brian. You're going to be taken care of. And so I went with my nephew. I had my nephew there with me. He was kind of like there to support me. And I said, hey, wait outside. If I, you know, if I don't come out in like 10 minutes or an hour or whatever it was, like, call the police. And so I made amends with my father, and he made amends with me too. But that, as he knew how to. He was a sick alcoholic. He died a sick alcoholic. But he made amends in the way that he knew how to. I always wanted a relationship with my father. I always wanted that connection. I just had that desire to, and he would promise that we would do all these wonderful things, but we could never seem to do them because, well, I understand now because he was an alcoholic, more drinking's more important to him, right? So, you know, it wasn't about last year in January. And so I felt a little bit of connection. My dad, I used to call him, you know, but I still felt that wall up, you know, I still felt that wall between the two of us. So January of last year, they said, hey, Brian, your dad doesn't have much time to live, so you better come see him. So I came to see him, and I told him all the wonderful things that he wanted to hear about himself. I told him about how he took care of us, how he made sure that we weren't hungry, how he made sure we had a house overhead. I didn't say one bad thing about him. Daddy, I love you, you know. And I felt those walls come crumbling down that I had against my father, and I would have missed all of that. Came back home, fast forward 2 weeks, so like, hey, your dad's got only a couple days to live. Like, I was just there, you know. But I made my way back to Iowa, again, with two plane rides to Burlington Arm. And he didn't die on the second day, he died on the seventh day. And that night I took watch, I took night watch, and that night I wrote his eulogy. And I said all the wonderful things about him, not one bad thing, not even one questionable thing about him. And after I wrote his eulogy, I felt all the walls come tumbling. I felt just connected with him, like you know, as a baby at birth. And I told him, Daddy, I love you. And it was so genuine. And I felt that connection that I'd been desiring my entire life for the first time to this guy who was like in a vegetated state next to me. But I felt more connected to him than I ever did in my entire life. And that next morning, I read the eulogy to my husband. And right after I finished reading the eulogy, my dad passed away. And I would have missed all of that if it wasn't for you guys in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and teaching, and Philo, teaching me how to open my heart, teaching me how to love somebody unconditionally, not because of what they're giving to me, not because of what I'm getting from them, not because of money or drugs or alcohol or sexual connection, but just because of love and pure intimacy. And I would have missed all that. And fast forward, a couple months later, September of last year, my sponsor, Philo, he sent me a message. He says, hey, Brian, there's something going on. You know, it's not doesn't look good. You know, I'm going into surgery. They're gonna come see me now. And I got 1 minute, thank you. And what happened was I went there in the hospital. And before he went into surgery and they found out what he had, he said, Brian, you're a good man. And I'm like, wow, this is about you. It's not about me. But in that moment where he needed me the most, he was thinking about me. Constant thought of others. Right, Tim? Constant thought of others. And so that's what Philo was all, was for me. For him to tell me that I was a good man was the biggest thing ever. And for me to be there with him in the months before he passed away, to be there with him and all these beautiful people over here was the biggest gift I could have got. And I had felt this immense responsibility. Father was an amazing person. He carried an amazing message. I feel this immense responsibility as an alcoholic, as one of his sponsees, to carry his message forward. And I hope to the God that I understand today, you guys got just a little tiny bit of that message. It was Philo. Love you all.